He's a Messianic Jew. He is a national chess champion. He is a scientist, and he is sure Darwinian evolution is fatally flawed.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome, friends, to Thoroughly Jewish Thursday on the Line of Fire. In a few minutes, I'm going to be joined by a thoroughly Jewish guest, a Messianic Jew, who is a scientist, PhD in physical chemistry. And we'll continue talking this week about fatal flaws of Darwinian evolution. Michael Brown, delighted to be with you. Coming your way live from Nashville, Tennessee, once again. The National Religious Broadcasters Conference is coming to an end. I've got a couple little stories to tell you. First, a Jewish one, then a more general one. So there is a great friendship between Israel and leaders in the National Religious Broadcasters. And there is a lot of working together for common goals and support of tourism in Israel and educating Christians on the biblical basis of their faith. So sometimes you'll see some religious Jews here that are participating in different ways. So I'm getting on an elevator. Another gentleman is getting off the elevator. It looks like an Orthodox Jew. From the look of him, he did not look like a Gentile Christian Jewish wannabe, by which I mean a Gentile Christian who somehow becomes very enthusiastic about Jewish roots and ends up deciding they're going to dress like a Jew, like a religious Jew, which for the most part has nothing to do with the Bible and really doesn't help our overall witness to the Jewish people. Just little word of wisdom there. Anyway, as he's getting off the elevator, I'm getting on the elevator, or whatever it was, whichever the direction. I said to him, Shalom Aleichem, which would be a traditional way of greeting a Jewish person. Now, if you don't know any better, if you don't know better, you might respond back with Shalom Aleichem, which is literally peace upon you, but it's greetings. But if you know better, you respond with Aleichem Shalom. You turn it around, upon you, peace, right? So I said Shalom Aleichem. He said Aleichem Shalom. I said, okay, he's a religious Jew. So I ran into him later. We're going to get him on the air as soon as we can. He has been involved in political issues and terrorist issues, but he is working now full-time pro-life to try to get Jews standing against abortion, standing for the life of the baby in the womb, combating the strong association of American Jews with liberal social values and democratic pro-abortion voting records. So looking forward to that. I just thought that was cute on Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. This morning, though, for about an hour and a half, I sat with Janet Parshall, national radio host on Moody Radio, sat with Janet Parshall, Ann Polk, who's been on the show with us, Restored Hope Network, former lesbian, and then Justin Lee, who leads what's called the Gay Christian Network, and Brandon Robertson, a young man just in his early 20s, who started something called Revangelical to try to influence Christians to be, quote, more inclusive towards gays and lesbians. Anyway, it was a public forum put on by NRB. And my goal was simple, to reiterate that the biblical witness is 100% clear that God made men for women and women for men, and that's his plan, and that marriage is not to be deviated from, and that there's no questioning the plain sense of God's plan and intent. And the second point, we need to reach out with love, compassion, sensitivity, and gentleness to those who identify as gay and lesbian or who struggle with same-sex attraction. In that regard, I think it went wonderfully, wonderfully well. And to the extent those that I differed with on other issues also advocated reaching out with compassion, we were together in that. So hopefully early next week we'll be playing, maybe tomorrow. Otherwise on Monday, we plan to play excerpts from the discussion, and it was videotaped. We'll hope to make that available soon. Right back with Dr. Jonathan Sarfati. You don't want to miss this.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back to The Line of Fire broadcast, 866-34-TRUTH, the number to call. This hour, if you have any question about Darwinian evolution, if you have a specific question about young Earth, is it possible to reconcile science and young Earth creationism? If you have a family member who's been confused by Darwinian evolution, my guest, Dr. Jonathan Sarfati, is a great person to take your questions. He's been on with us before. We had one of his colleagues, Dr. Roger Carter, on with us yesterday. Dr. Sarfati received his PhD in physical chemistry from Victoria University of Wellington, New Zealand. He's co-authored papers in mainstream scientific journals, including one on high-temperature superconductors, published in Nature when he was 22 years old. He has been a national chess champion in New Zealand. One of his books that he wrote was in response to Richard Dawkins. It's called The Greatest Hoax on Earth, Refuting Dawkins on Revolution. Jonathan, it's great to have you back on the broadcast. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Dr. Brown. This is the third time I've had the pleasure.
Wonderful. Yes, and it was great to have one of your colleagues on yesterday. Now, this is our Thursday broadcast, which is normally devoted to Jewish themes, but with our focus on the DVD, on the Achilles heels of evolution, we're spreading out interviews on different days. But when I saw your name, of course, I knew you were Jewish because your last name, Sarfati, would be a Frenchman.
Yep.
Were you raised in a traditional Jewish home or secular?
No, I'm afraid not, because my father basically was a Holocaust refugee. He didn't actually get into the concentration camps, but he was separated from his father as a child during World War II. And I think he decided that Jewishness was more trouble than it was worth. He'd seen anti-Semitism firsthand.
Got it. And is it after you came to faith that you you realized that there was something to Jewish roots?
Oh, that is very important to me. The fact that the Messiah is Jewish, and in fact, that's my own heritage, which I was became far more interested in.
Got it. Now, just for fun, what was your PhD thesis written on?
It was a spectroscopic study of chalcogenide ring and cage molecules. So I was using vibrational spectroscopy, Raman and infrared, analyzing the way selenium compounds, the molecular strengths vary when in certain chemical environments.
Yeah, I looked at that and I thought I'm not even going to try to pronounce that. So that was just for those who think, well, if he believes in young Earth creation, he's just one of these spitting fundamentalists who just the Bible says, well, we believe what Scripture says. I mean, that is our foundation. But obviously, you haven't turned your mind off, Dr. Sarfati, to do what you're doing. If I asked you the same question I put to Dr. Carter yesterday, the number one or two reason that you reject as a whole, the whole system, Darwinian evolution, what would be the number one, number two strongest reasons you would bring?
I'd say the number one is, in fact, my own chapter in the Achilles heel book about the origin of first life, you see, because you can only talk about natural selection, which is differential reproduction, when you have things that can reproduce. But the trying to get self-reproducing entities from a primordial soup is chemically impossible as well as informationally impossible. So they can't even get evolution started to start undergoing the Darwinian processes of mutation and natural selection. That they can't even get evolution off the ground from naturalistic chemistry. I think that's a key problem, and you find a lot of evolutionists don't even want to discuss the origin of first life, pretend it's not really evolution, even though it's called chemical evolution.
Now, I once saw Richard Dawkins on O'Reilly, and O'Reilly said something about the origins of life. Yeah. And if I recall, Dawkins' answer was kind of the standard, we're working on that. So the impression you get is if you give science enough time, they'll figure things out. But that's not necessarily a consistently logical position. There are certain things that are self-contradictory, and no matter how much time you have to figure it out, it's not going to work. Is this the kind of thing that science cannot provide a rational answer for outside of a creator?
Well, you know that his statement is actually a statement of faith, in a sense, and is also implying that he's some sort of prophet about what science is going to uncover in the future, which is admitting that science today hasn't got the answer. But then creationists also do research to try to solve problems that evolutionists throw up, and apparently we're supposed to surrender as soon as there's a problem we can't answer right now, as opposed to, well, this is what we're working on. If the evolutionists are allowed that argument, and then so a creationist allowed to do the same thing. And in fact, in my study of this issue over 20 years, I think science is throwing up more and more problems for chemical evolution rather than solving them.
Yeah, and my impression from a distance as a non-scientist was the more scientific discoveries we make, the harder it's going to be to have an atheistic Darwinian approach to creation. Let me play a clip for you. This is from the DVD, The Achilles Heels of Evolution, and then you can comment on it. One of the scholars, everyone on here, they're PhDs, they're scientists, they're scholars dealing with fundamentally important issues of life and human mechanism and how we got here and how we get around. Let's play this clip, then you can expand on it for us.
So everybody talks about natural selection, and they kind of almost imagine like it's a magic wand. It's an explanation for everything. Natural selection is simply differential reproduction. In all living systems, in all populations, some individuals reproduce more than others. That is natural selection.
All right. Could you explain that further for us?
Okay. That's Dr. John Sanford, who was the inventor of the great gene gun, talking. And he was just defining what natural selection, but you notice how he backed up what I said. Natural selection is differential reproduction. And so this presupposes that you have things that are already capable of reproducing. And that is what pure chemistry cannot provide.
All right. So what kind of answer do people come up with on the other side when you say, okay, you have to start with something and it's not, even where did the something, even if the something was a blob or a piece of dust, I mean, where did it come from? But what do evolutionists say? I mean, Dawkins says we're working on it, mm-hmm. but they must have filled that line in somewhere with something. What is it?
Oh, okay, in a lot of the textbooks, the high school textbooks, you have what's called the Miller-Urey experiments. They spark, they put a spark or ultraviolet in some sort of gas mixture, which they thought was on the primordial Earth, and now they're disputing even that side of it. And they're getting a few very simple compounds like amino acids in the mixture. And they say, well, there you go, we're already partway there. But the thing is, amino acids are not life. They're not even close to life because, first of all, you have to combine them into proteins, but even the proteins don't work unless you've got other proteins working with them, and you cannot reproduce them unless you have something like a DNA genetic system to pass the information along that builds the right protein to the next one in line, the offspring. So most people may have heard of the Miller-Urey experiments, but they need to know that this is nowhere near getting life from non-living chemicals. And in fact, if you look at the chemistry, in fact, it's very good evidence as to why life is not going to form under such conditions.
All right. Now, your own studies, your doctoral studies, obviously were highly specialized. How do they play in, or your ongoing background in chemistry, how do these things play in with you seeing through the flaws of Darwinian evolution?
Well, I mean, certainly in my chemistry degree, there was a lot of organic chemistry, which is the chemistry of carbon compounds. And it's very interesting how the more you learned about organic chemistry, you saw how the real chemistry contradicts the evolutionary story about how organic molecules actually behave. Because, for instance, if I wanted to make a protein from amino acids, the last thing I'm going to have there is water, because water will push the reaction back to the individual amino acids and away from the protein. So any chemist will try to exclude water and remove any water that's around. But then they say evolution is supposed to have occurred where there's lots of water in a primordial ocean. So the real chemistry that I have actually had experience in the organic chemistry labs goes against the claims of chemical evolution.
Okay. You've got thinking people, you've got scholars, you've got academics. What do they do when they're confronted with some of these contradictions that are so clear to a scientific thinker?
Well, I find they often ignore them. You probably won't find any acknowledgement of the chemical problems in anything Richard Dawkins has written, for instance. I think he just doesn't want to even touch these ideas. And also, it's notable that when you look at some of the more the specialists in chemical evolution, often the best arguments against one theory is made by the proponents of another theory. And I, of course, I'd say they're both right. Both their criticisms are equally valid, and chemical evolution didn't happen at all.
Yeah, you know, what's just so interesting is we're the ones who are accused of being obscurantistic mm-hmm. and closed-minded and sticking our head in the sand, and yet there's obviously a lot invested emotionally and in many other ways in the Darwinian evolutionary system. And the biggest thing, when I got saved, my biggest issue was not drugs, it was pride. Mm-hmm. To say I was wrong, you stake your whole reputation on things. Dr. Sarfati will continue to challenge you to think about facts. We'll get to some calls. If you have a question, 866-34-TRUTH.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
My friends, we are devoting this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday to my Messianic Jewish guest, Dr. Jonathan Sarfati. He's been very gracious. I've had him on a couple times before this and always put the accent on the wrong part of his name. Finally got it right today. Great tool that he and his ministry have produced. Creation.com is the website. They are young earth creation scientists. It's really, I was amazed at the clarity of the presentation, how lucid the speakers were, how good the graphics were. It's on the Achilles heels of evolution. The DVD plus my interview with Dr. Sarfati today and Dr. Roger Carter yesterday. We've got a special offer on it, great pricing. So call 1-800-278-9978. 1-800-278-9978, or go to the website, Ask Dr. Brown, askdrbrown.org, and you can order straight from there. Dr. Sarfati, you deal with this full time. How many people come to you that have lost faith in God or the Bible or are being deeply challenged simply because of evolutionary teaching?
I think that would be the number one, at least, justification for abandoning the faith they may have been brought up with. It happens way too often. And unfortunately, in many cases, they've got no answers in the church they're going to or in the family they grew up with. Often it was this fideism you were talking about, just believe the Bible, and that's with no explanation as to why we should believe the Bible or how we can show the Bible to be true. Those are missing in a lot of circles.
And how the people that come to the website, creation.com, that read the books, that watch the DVDs, do you hear from them afterwards or maybe a family that's helping out, a family member, that now they have felt intellectually that they can come back to examining the scriptures again?
Oh, we've got hundreds of people like that, actually.
Yeah, it's got to be gratifying. And I was shocked because it never impacted me. I just never was focused on science issues and things. So I kind of bypassed that. I got hit with the Jewish objections and other larger objections to the faith. Mm-hmm. How many people have been discouraged from believing in the God of the Bible because of this teaching? From a purely scientific viewpoint, and I know that you don't separate that from your faith in God and Scripture, but right. From a purely scientific viewpoint, in your view, who has the stronger argument in terms of the age of the Earth and the universe, young Earth creationists or old Earth creationists?
Oh, the young Earth, definitely.
And, all right, give us some reasons why.
Okay, first of all, we have this unstable isotope you would have heard of it, carbon-14, has a half-life of 5,500 years. Now, you'll see on the DVD that I'm saying that if the whole Earth was pure carbon-14, it would all decompose within a million years. There should be no detectable carbon-14 left in anything over a million years old, and yet we're finding carbon-14 in things like coal and in diamonds, which is, diamonds are meant to be over a billion years old, the hardest substance on Earth, apart from the human heart anyway, so they can't be contaminated, and yet they have carbon-14 in, which means they have not existed long enough for the carbon-14 to have decayed. So that's like a very powerful case for the young Earth. Another one involves all the soft tissue and even DNA we're finding in dinosaur bones. Now, dinosaurs were meant to have died out 65 million years ago, but then you can measure the rate of DNA. And even if you froze it to 23 Fahrenheit, it should all be gone, disintegrated into completely after under 7 million years. Now, we're finding quite intact DNA in dinosaur bones, which are supposed to be 10 times older than the maximum possible time of DNA survival. And dinosaurs were meant to have lived in a warm climate where things break down far more quickly. So I think finding DNA in dinosaur bones is very powerful evidence. I don't think that when I say we, I said scientist Dr. Mary Schweitzer is the one who's actually found this. She's not a young earther, but it's interesting how this really goes against her old earth beliefs.
Very interesting. So how is she reporting it? Is she saying, I don't know how to process this evidence?
I think her DNA is something she hasn't come to terms with. Other things like protein, she thinks that if you have very concentrated iron solution, you might preserve it. I think what she's done is preserved blood vessels for 2 years, but I think when you're talking about millions of years, it's not going to cut it.
Got it. And by the way, I hate to ask you something this elementary, but when people say, okay, where were dinosaurs and where were they created and were people and dinosaurs on the planet at the same time, the answer you give is what?
Well, they were among the beasts of the earth that God created on day six of creation week, and God created man, male and female, on day six of creation week, so they must have lived at the same time. Now, we don't find them fossilized together, but then we don't find quite a few things fossilized that we know lived together. We never find coelacanth and whale fossils together, but of course we know they're alive and well in the sea nowadays, so... the premise that you have to find something fossilized together to prove it lived together is just a false premise. And there are the other things, looks like the creature in Job chapter 40, the behemoth, describing a tail like a cedar, which is the biggest tree in the Middle East. So you're describing a creature with an enormous tail there, which sounds like a sauropod dinosaur to me. It doesn't sound like an elephant or a hippo because they have tiny little tails.
So let's just say, for argument's sake, that the book of Job, the characters, when it's written, is later. Let's say the characters are placed in patriarchal times, as I would understand it, as I'm working on my Job commentary.
Oh, nice.
So are you saying that they had a memory of dinosaurs at that time, or that dinosaurs actually existed at that time?
Honestly, when God tells Job, behold, behemoth, that seems to me that he's expecting Job to know of a creature that's alive at the time he's talking, and it describes him in the present. He eats grass like an ox, and he swings his tail like a cedar. It seems like it's a creature that God expected Job to know about.
Yeah, you know, and I'm only in chapter 32 now, but I've got to finish by the end of this year. You know, I've been working on it for a while, and I haven't landed on my opinion on the last chapters of Leviathan. So that last little question there was actually for me, that last part. Yeah, let me play another quick clip, and then we'll get to some calls. Dennis, clip number two. This is from the DVD, Achilles' Heels of Evolution.
The survival of the fittest does not explain the arrival of the fittest.
If natural selection only selects from what's already in the population, then how does evolutionary progress occur?
Mutations are the evolutionists' hoped for engine of evolution. And if that's true, there should be hundreds of examples that we could see today of mutations increasing the genetic information.
All right, your comment.
Well, that sort of backs up what Dr. Carter said yesterday about don't say micro versus macro. The point is the direction of the change. You see, as those guys said, it's a matter of trying to get information to go uphill. And natural selection is only culling information, not creating it. And mutations only corrupt the information. It doesn't make new information. So that combination is saying that the mutation and the selection will only be a stabilizing effect and a downhill effect. It will never produce the uphill changes that are needed to turn particles into people.
What a way of saying it. The uphill... Yeah, to turn particles into people. Aha, only God does that, and he transcends our natural means in the process.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
It is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, but we're focusing this hour on a creation scientist, himself a Messianic Jew, a chess champion, Dr. Jonathan Sarfati, part of the team at creation.com, Young Earth Creation Scientists. To find out about our special resource offer, go to my website, AskDrBrown, askdrbrown.org, and you will find this DVD and the interviews with Dr. Sarfati today and his colleague, Dr. Carter, yesterday. We'll be packaging it together. Don't want to miss that. Also, check out my latest article on a different subject entitled Ignore the Gay Trash Talk. You'll understand what it's about as you read it. Dr. Sarfati, let's grab some calls. Brad in Miami, Florida, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Okay, yeah, yeah. The doctor spoke about Dawkins and the evolutionists and how they postulated the origin of life through the primordial ooze and all that stuff, and he shot that theory down, citing his scientific, whatever. He got into pretty detailed organic chemistry there. But I'm just curious, does he have an opposing argument as to the origin of life that's based in science and evidence?
Do I think there's actually an origin of life that's based on science? I don't think so. The thing is, they've already made up their mind that life came from non-living chemicals, and all they're trying to do is find a scientific mechanism, but they've already decided on the conclusion before looking at the evidence. So I'd say a lot of the origin of life stuff is not science at all. It's actually it's trying to support a belief system of materialism.
Yeah, you cannot get away from that. The philosopher and atheist Thomas Nagel made clear he doesn't want there to be a God. He finds that naturalism cannot really explain the origin of life or the universe, but he hopes it's right because he doesn't want there to be a God. There is a belief system, as you said, in materialism. What about the Stephen Hawking's idea that somehow gravity is behind the creation of the universe? Now, look, he obviously is brilliant, and he forgets in a minute more science than I've learned in my lifetime. But I read that, and I had Dr. John Lennox on the air with me saying, first, where does the law of gravity come from? And then how does this create? It was so mind-boggling. Can you comment on that?
Well, in fact, gravity can't possibly help you explain the origin of life from non-living chemicals. You can put whatever gravitational field or gradient you like. You're not going to get chemicals combining into a self-reproducing cell. So I think that's, I guess, what Hawking is talking about is the origin of the universe itself and trying to pretend that that's gravity. I wrote an article on Hawking, creation.com/Hawking, and I cite Dr. Lennox in support, because he was quite very insightful on that. Hawking was talking about the origin of the universe, not the origin of life so much.
Got it. But even almost on a broader level, when you're talking the origin of the universe, here I'm thinking at it as a non-scientist, where did the law of gravity come from? Who set this up? I mean, you're talking about the universe literally operating based on laws and mathematical principles, correct?
Right, that's exactly right. And they're so finely tuned that it's just not – I mean, even some evolutionists have said that it looks like some sort of giant intellect to be monkeying around with the laws of nature.
Give me one example of how finely tuned the universe is.
Well, I mean, comparing this gravitational strength with the strength of the electromagnetic forces and how finely tuned, how balanced they have to be. It's like balancing so accurately, like shooting a bullseye at the end of the other end of the universe. Because if they're slightly out of sync, then either stars could not form, atoms could not form, and life could not exist.
It's
slightly off balance, and yet there's so many more things that have to be totally right before the universe could even support life.
Exactly. And then, friends, on this DVD that creation.com has put out, Christian Ministries, working together, these scientists, I'm sitting there, again, thinking, this God's amazing. What a God we serve. We'll be back. We've got a lot more time.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
The website to go to, creation.com, Young Earth Creation Scientist, Dr. Jonathan Sarfati, on with me today, has said that he believes from a scientific viewpoint, not simply biblical, but scientific viewpoint, that the Young Earth creation view is the most palatable, the most likely based on science and not just based on scripture. Dr. Sarfati, earlier in the show, I asked you your number one reason, number one fatal flaw of Darwinian evolution. You've hit it from some other angles, but what would be a number two or three on your list if we haven't covered those yet?
Well, I mean, it's sort of it relates to what Dr. Carter is talking about, the genetics. I'm talking about the origin of first life, but also how life continues to reproduce. Like, for instance, DNA reproduces and is decoded by protein. DNA codes for proteins, but the decoding machinery is made of proteins. So, and DNA has the instructions to code for its own decoding machines. So it's a chicken and egg problem, like which came first, the decoding machines, which are proteins, or the DNA that codes for those decoding machines, because you can't have one without the other. And the decoding machines use energy, which is this molecule ATP, which is made by the tiniest motor in the universe. You'll see that on the DVD. And yet again, to build that motor, you need the instructions on the DNA, and you need the decoding machines to decode those, but the decoding machines use energy, therefore they need ATP made by those motors, which are coded with DNA. It's got a three-way vicious circle for life to keep going. And so you've got all these integrated processes that have to work all together, otherwise life could not exist.
Right, and as Dr. Carter was explaining yesterday, the fact is that they can't just start. Everything has to be together the right way. If you're missing a piece in the machine, then the machinery doesn't work, and yet the machine has to work perfectly from the start, but it allegedly evolved to get there. So again, the system simply doesn't work. What about someone saying, well, the universe is eternal, matter is eternal? Obviously, that's a statement of faith. They have no scientific evidence for it. But how do you respond to that when someone is simply giving something that's a statement of faith? Well, matter always was.
But see, I know yesterday you had this gentleman citing Maimonides, who was citing Aristotle. But we've moved a long way from that, because we have a second law of thermodynamics. So you see, we've got two laws of thermodynamics. One says energy can't be created or destroyed, but you've got a second law that says the usable energy in the universe is running out. And since we're not run out now, it follows that it must have been wound up at some definite time in the past. You see, if the universe was eternal, like Aristotle believed, we should already have run out of usable energy. And so these two laws of thermodynamics are very important evidence that the universe really did have a beginning and it's not eternal. So Aristotle did not know about thermodynamics, which totally blows him away.
Got it. All clear. All right, let's go back to the phones. Georgetown, Massachusetts. Ibrahim, welcome to the Line of Fire.
It's actually Ibrahim, but
Ibrahim, okay.
My question is, in terms of evolution, most people who endorse evolution, especially those who practice or support homosexuality, I see a contradiction between evolution and homosexuality, which because evolution says that only the strong genes get to survive. But if you use that argument against people who support or practice homosexuality, it means that they are the weaker genes and which are not going to survive to the next generation. But you cannot use that argument. So I'm just trying to understand what's the perception about that, and whether it's because evolution is considered like it's not working right now, or I'd like to hear your take on that.
Oh, okay.
Thank you.
I think that is a point, isn't it? Because you find that the evolutionary regime of the Nazis, well, in fact, Hitler actually wouldn't have got to power without homosexuals like Röhm, the leader of the brown shirt. But as soon as he came into power, he's persecuted homosexuals because they were an anti-evolutionary malfunction, because they're not reproducing themselves, therefore they're not contributing to evolution. But of course, the other thing is, evolution can't give you right and wrong. See, evolution can't say any behavior is right or wrong, and that includes the behavior of murdering homosexuals. Evolution can't say that's wrong either. But I will say that most homosexuals now would be pro-evolution, because it gets away from the idea that there's a God who has said that marriage is a man and a woman, and therefore any deviation, missing the mark from that, is a sin. So evolutionists do have tried to explain homosexuality away, not convincingly, but they really have no basis for saying anything for gay rights can't be derived from any philosophical system.
Yeah, what about the survival of the fittest? How does that fit in with the survival of individuals who we recognize are loved by God, and Jesus shed the same blood for each of them?
Yeah.
And yet, you seem to have homosexuality in all different civilizations and through history. How does that work out with the survival of the fittest? Or is that just, if there can't be physical reproduction, or is that just part of fallen human nature? We have all types of different ways we develop.
Well, I'd say, is it because we're all sinners, and homosexuality is one aspect of sin? But it's definitely a sin. It's missing the mark of God's plan. But it's interesting how even Richard Dawkins has said quite famously that he believes passionately in Darwinian evolution as a rule for science, but he's passionately anti-Darwinian when it comes to society. He does not want to have a society ruled by Darwinian evolution, which means he has to get his morality outside his evolutionary ideas. He cannot use evolution as a basis to run society.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad he's inconsistent in that regard, because the society runs simply by the survival of the fittest. There is no morality. There can be no possible morality except whatever we have to do to be the top of the food chain. All right, let's go back to the phones. Queens, New York. Jess, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Yeah, hey, guys. Appreciate you taking my call. Hey, I had a quick question about how we look at star life, mm-hmm. and that we have stars that are millions of light years away from the Earth. However, that seems like we fly in the face of any kind of younger creationist mm-hmm. ideal.
Well, that's actually, we see those stars today. We have that quite well illustrated on the Achilles Heel DVD. We have, I'm one of the people who talks about that, as is Dr. Jim Mason, and of course, cosmologist Dr. John Hartner talks about that. And one thing we point out is that the problem you raise is saying there are more light years than there are years, if we believe in a 6,000-year-old Earth. Isn't that the sort of thing you're saying? But in fact, every belief system has more light years than years. The Big Bang has more light years than years because of the horizon problem we explained, that everything in the universe is at the same temperature, background temperature, about 3 degrees above absolute zero. But there's no way for the objects to have been in contact. You look at something 10 light years east, and 10 billion light years east and 10 billion light years west, 20 billion light years apart, and they're at the same temperature, but the Big Bang was only 14 billion years ago. So there's no time for light to go from one part to the other to equalize the temperatures. So they have a problem, and they try and solve it by having the universe expand much faster than light, which is what the inflation idea is. But to do that, they have to have gravity running in reverse, and they haven't got a mechanism to start this faster than light expansion or to stop it once it's begun. So it's clearly a fudge factor to rescue their own big distant starlight problem. And the thing is, when you look at some of the creationist models, they are also talking about expansion of space to solve the same distant starlight problem, and that's what Dr. Hart explains in the DVD. But to point out, the Big Bangers have exactly the same problem in principle.
Mm. Great angle to come at. Hey, thank you for the call. Mm. All right, I want to play one more clip. We'll have one more in the next break. Clip number three, Dennis. This is from the DVD, The Achilles Heels of Evolution.
You see, there's nothing in chemistry alone that would put any sort of coded information into a molecule. I mean, even if you could get nucleotides to form in a chemical soup, and even if you could get them to form a chain, you'd have nothing but a random string of letters. If you were to wait for a very long time and by chance produce a coherent string with a real instruction, even then, it would be just one clear message in a sea of random messages. This is the opposite of what life requires. Life requires lots of information, tightly controlled and protected, able to be copied, able to be fixed when an error appears. And all of this must be present the first time life appears.
All right. I'm going to get Dr. Sarfati's comment on that on the other side of the break. I know he can hold the thought because he's played blind chess with as many as 12 different opponents at the same time. That's all from memory. So he'll hold on to that quote till we come back.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back to the Line of Fire. So here's how you get the DVD. It is 96 minutes. It is chock full of clear, fundamental objections to Darwinian evolution with factual presentation, scientific presentation that will build your faith. Certainly, we all know of people who've lost faith, who've been discouraged, who've gotten confused in their beliefs because they think the Bible's not compatible with facts of science. So how can we trust it and other intangible spiritual matters? And because of that, many confused. But for me, it was wonderful, informative faith building. We're packaging it together with the CDs from the interview today with Dr. Jonathan Sarfati and yesterday's interview with Dr. Roger Carter. And a great price for all the package together. Go to Ask Dr. Brown, askdrbrown.org. Right on the homepage, you can find out more. Dr. Sarfati, since you played blind chess with 11, 12 different people, I knew it wouldn't be a problem for you to remember that quote until the other side of the break. So your comments then.
Right. But what Dr. Carter was saying is that you can have all the chemistry you like. You can even grant that they can make chains of amino acids and chains of nucleotides and get some sort of DNA. But what you're not going to get is the information content that is required for life. Even the simplest organism has 600 kilobytes of highly compressed information. We have about 3 gigabytes of highly compressed information that he talked about yesterday. And it's in chemistry is not going to get you the information that is needed for life. It'll get you chains of things, but it won't make you give you the information thing any more than, for instance, you could, if you got ink for a primordial soup, it is not the same as writing a book with that ink. To write that book, you need the organization into the letters and the words, sentences, and paragraphs. Getting the chemistry of the ink is nowhere near making the book. And saying getting the chemistry of life is not the same as getting the information that's required for life.
So the whole idea that if you had enough monkeys in a room pounding away at a typewriter and enough time that you'd end up that somehow Shakespeare would be produced, is that a fair statement or is that completely bogus thinking?
Absolutely bogus thinking, because you can work out time, the probability, even uncountably many times the Big Bang age of the universe, you're not going to get the works of Shakespeare. And also, while these works are being typed, the pages are disintegrating as well. That's more of an analogy. The chemistry is going backwards and disintegrating, undoing the sort of things that you've done. So imagine monkeys on a typewriter, but the pages are slowly decaying as they're typing. That's more like it.
Yeah, so again, everything is going downhill, whereas creation and God's design for life had to go uphill. Let me play one more clip and get your expansion on it. Clip number 4, Dennis.
Sure.
Many evolutionists claim that the origin of life is not part of evolution, but come on, they believe that all living things came from a single cell, which in turn came from a primordial soup. So they have to have a theory of life coming from non-living chemicals, otherwise materialism is dead in the water. For evolutionists to believe in chemical evolution, this is not a position they got from science, but a position they got from blind faith.
All right. Overstated.
Right, basically, what I've been talking about earlier in the show. Exactly what I've been talking about. That was me speaking, just so you know. So that was basically what I've been talking about. The chemical evolution is an essential part of the materialistic worldview, and material should not be allowed to escape from those difficulties. They need to be, their feet need to be held to the fire. They've got to explain life from non-living chemicals, and they just can't do it.
Now, is there a growing movement of scientists who are abandoning Darwinian evolution?
Well, I think there is, but they're often, if you ever saw the movie Expelled, you'll see that there's a lot of repercussions for people coming out as anti-Darwinians. People have lost their job for saying so, just by being intelligent design type people has been enough to jeopardize careers. So I'd say there are a lot more who are keeping their heads down.
Got it. Yeah, and it's when you have the truth, you bring everything to light. You're not threatened. You don't intimidate. You don't bully. When you have the truth, you let the truth speak for itself. Mm-hmm. Let me grab one more quick call before we're done. Gina on Long Island, thanks for calling the Line of Fire.
Hi, I have a comment. For the past 18 months, I've been writing a book on evolution. I'm a believer, and the Lord has just led me to so much research. And in 18 months, there really isn't everything that I researched. They present as fact, and it can all be debunked. And there are a lot of scientists out there that, unless people are really aware of it, they would have no idea that a lot of the scientific community does not accept it as fact, because in fact it's not. But for some reason, it's presented in the schools as fact, in textbooks as fact. Mm-hmm. And we also recently took a trip to the Creation Museum in Kentucky, and very aware of their ministry. So a lot, everything he's saying is exactly true.
Yeah, and as you're saying, Dr. Safarty, there's the pressure, the intimidation. You don't want to buck the tide, and yet at some point the tide will be bucked. Just for the edification of our listeners, and so they'll know about the DVD and your website, just take a minute or two, give us some of the credentials or background of some of your fellow young Earth creation scientists.
Okay, we've got Dr. Carter, you already know, who's a geneticist and marine biologist. You had him yesterday. On the video, we have Dr. John Hart, who's a full professor, tenured professor of physics at the University of South Australia. I think it is. It's in South Australia. Dr. Don Batten, whose voice we heard earlier. He had a great career in plant physiology and plant breeding before he became a full-time creation. Dr. David Catchpole is roughly the same. You heard his voice too. Dr. John Sanford, we heard on the DVD, not in the book, but on the DVD, inventor of the gene gun. We have Dr. Jim Mason, who's a nuclear physicist who talks very well about radioactive dating, and he is right in his area of expertise. We had Marcus Ross on the DVD, but not in the book, who's a paleontologist, a PhD paleontologist from Rhode Island University. So all the people, there are 15 PhDs on the DVD, 9 in the book. They're all earned their doctorates from accredited secular universities, not from degree mills or things, but real from real universities. And all of us accept a young Earth creation position.
Yeah. So friends, don't be intimidated by materialistic arguments. Don't be intimidated by people say, you fundamentalists, you stick your head in the sand. These are thinking people. These are scientists. And really, any of the guests we've had on, push the button, and they've got tons of information. Thank you for doing what you do and making yourself available and putting out this fantastic DVD.
Been a pleasure talking to you again.
Yes. One of these days we'll meet face-to-face, I hope.
Oh, I hope so.
Yeah. Hope so. All right. God bless you, dear brother.
God bless.
All right, friends. So, this is what you do. Call right now, 1-800-278-9978. 1-800-278-9978. A beautifully, powerfully produced DVD on the fatal flaws of Darwinian evolution. Even if you've never struggled with it or had a question, your faith will be built up. Look at what kind of a God do we have. Amazing. Look at what he's put into the human being and the world. And It's just great stuff. And the interviews today with Dr. Safarty and yesterday's Dr. Carter, only $25 postage paid. Order as many copies as you want. Call 1-800-278-9978. 1-800-278-9978. My bottom line today, talk about being fearfully and wonderfully made. Talk about the heavens declaring the glory of God. Wow. Change the world. It is thoroughly Jewish Thursday. So much happening in the Jewish world and beyond. We'll cover it all right here.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome to the Line of Fire on this thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Last hour was different for Thursday, but it was Jewish. My guest was young earth creation scientist Dr. Jonathan Sarfati, and we had a great discussion about numerous creation-related issues and interface with science, tying in with the terrific DVD that we're offering this week. We'll tell you more about that in a bit. I had a fascinating discussion earlier today, as I'm here in Nashville, Tennessee, coming away live from Nashville with a religious Jewish man who used to be highly connected in the political scene and dealing with terrorist issues, and was telling me some pretty shocking things about stuff known to America for years of people coming in through the border, our southern border, coming into Arizona and coming in clearly with Muslim terrorist backgrounds, basically with the door wide open to them. I'm not saying that to instill fear. I am saying that to say we do have some real security issues, and the fact that our administration refuses to identify and recognize and address Islamic terrorism as Islamic terrorism further undercuts what we are doing. 866-34-TRUTH. Any Jewish related question you have of any kind, be it related to the Hebrew Bible, be it a Jewish objection to Jesus the Messiah, be it just a general Hebrew question, a Jewish tradition, or having to do with modern state of Israel, the Middle East, we'll do our best to get to questions today. 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. The plot continues to thicken as we get closer and closer to Prime Minister Netanyahu's expected speech to Congress, the opposition mounting. I mean, I've never seen in my lifetime that I can remember, I've never seen a conflict between the President of America and the Prime Minister of Israel on this level, this deep, being played out this publicly. Whatever may have existed before, behind the scenes, I don't know. But what is playing out publicly, to me, seems unprecedented. If somebody can tell me about something else that I'm missing in our history, and it could well be, I don't claim to be a modern American historian, but this is extraordinary. And who's going to boycott the speech? But check this out. You want to hear the plot thickening. Check it. Let me just scroll down to this note here. Here we go. European officials say that Saudi Arabia is just as concerned as Israel over the details of the nuclear agreement the Obama administration is currently negotiating with Iran, and is even prepared to facilitate an Israeli airstrike on Iran's nuclear facilities should it come to that. According to a unnamed senior European diplomat appearing on Israel's Channel 2 News, quote, "The Saudis have declared their readiness for the Israeli Air Force to overfly Saudi airspace en route to attack Iran if an attack is necessary." The report, if credible, is a major blow to the Obama administration, which insists that Israel's urgent criticism of its proposed deal with Iran is unwarranted. Secretary of State John Kerry told a congressional hearing on Tuesday, "Anybody running around right now jumping in to say, well, we don't like the deal or this or that, doesn't know what the deal is." And Prime Minister Netanyahu says, well, then bring us in on it. If it's a good deal, tell us. Israel's Minister of Strategic Affairs, Yuval Steinitz, responded by suggesting that perhaps it's Kerry that lacks the full picture. "We know all we need to know, and we have an excellent picture of the negotiations. Maybe Kerry doesn't know everything we know." That's my view. Or he's not acting on it properly. 866-34-TRUTH. We will be right back on 30 Jewish Thursday.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back, friends, to The Line of Fire. Dennis, grab clip number 6. This is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. I'll take your thoroughly Jewish questions on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday and do my best to give a thoroughly Jewish answer based on scripture, based on truth. 866-348-7884. This is Susan Rice speaking again. The subject, Islamic terror, Middle East security. Let's listen.
The relationship between Israel as a country and the United States as a country has always been bipartisan. And we've been fortunate that politics have not been injected into that relationship. What has happened over the last several weeks, by virtue of the invitation that was issued
by the Speaker
and the acceptance of it by Prime Minister Netanyahu on 2 weeks in advance of his election, is that on both sides there has now been injected a degree of partisanship, which is not only unfortunate, I think it's destructive of the fabric of the relationship.
Oh, wait a second. Why did it have to be politicized? Why couldn't it have simply been the prime minister invited over? I know it's in the midst of Israeli elections, but it could be a plus or a minus in that front. In other words, if Prime Minister Netanyahu did really well and it played out well in America, that would be considered a plus in his election campaign. If it didn't play out well in America, if the speech wasn't good overall, that'd be a negative. But we need to hear it. We need to hear it. You're talking about our negotiations with their neighbor who wants to annihilate them, according to public statements, and could well have a nuclear bomb. Don't you think that Israel has a stake in that? Well, my friend Rabbi Shmuley has weighed in, Susan Rice, and the politicization of genocide. He said, is there any dirty job for the Obama administration that Susan Rice is not prepared to do? Need someone to fraudulently blame the murder of an American ambassador in Libya on a stupid film? Send Susan to the Sunday talk shows. Need someone to savage the leader of the only democracy in the Middle East is damaging the fabric. We just heard that quote of Israel's relationship with the United States. Put Susan in the makeup chair of Charlie Rose. That's what you're listening to. And anyway, he goes on with a litany of issues, and he says, Iran is threatening to annihilate Israel. It is building the bombs to make that possible. It has lied to the world for more than a decade about its nuclear program. Iran is an oil superpower and energy exporter that needs nuclear energy about as much as I need a pork sandwich. America is about to do a bad deal with Iran that will leave them something in the range of 5,000 spinning centrifuges enriching uranium. Israel is not party to the talks. It has been cast in the same position of Czechoslovakia in the Munich Agreement of 1938, where Britain and France negotiated away Czech security in much of the country without the Czechs even allowed to be present. Shmuley's completely right. It is utterly outrageous, and we need to stand up and say to the administration, we are standing with Israel. We are standing with Prime Minister Netanyahu. We recognize that the Iranian people are people like everyone else, but they are exporting terror around the world, and they cannot be trusted with nuclear arms. And some of their leaders may have end-time views about the calamitous end of the world and everything kind of going up in smoke and the final rise of Islamic power. And could nuclear capabilities play into that? It could be. Could be. But this much I know, Israel is our ally, right? Israel is our best friend in the Middle East. Israel is the one true democracy, and we're going to shut them out of the negotiations and the conversations with Iran. They're protesting. We're going to ignore it. And then the prime minister wants to address Congress on this issue. We're going to try to stonewall that? Not good. Not good. Not right. Let's go to Lake Isabella, California. Joel, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hello, Dr. Brown.
Hello.
My question is about the Book of Enoch, and I'm just curious if this is something that the Israelites would have studied or read, and where the origins of it come from, in your opinion.
Sure. Now, when you say the Israelites, are you talking about any particular time of history?
Yeah, like when did they start? When was that? Those books. Like, when would the Israelites have been studying those books?
Right. Okay. So even though it's quoted in the book of Judah in the New Testament as quoting Enoch, and even though it may preserve traditions that went all the way back to Enoch, the oldest parts of the book of Enoch are only a few centuries before the time of Jesus. In other words, the oldest parts of the book of Enoch originate from after the end of the Old Testament period. After the end of the last books of the Old Testament, then that's when the book of Enoch is basically being written. So by the time of the first century, much of it was finished. Some of it may still have been being worked on. We don't have any original Hebrew or Aramaic of the whole of the book. The oldest full copy we have is many centuries later in what's called Ethiopic, the Ge'ez language. But we know that among first century Jews, those who followed Jesus, those who didn't, as well as Gentile followers of Jesus in the centuries after, it was a revered book, but never included in the canon of Scripture. So it was read with interest as an important book, but it was not a book of that was ever considered Scripture by any wide group of believers or something that was not going to be part of the canonical text. And it's a later book. It's called Pseudepigrapha. The Apocrypha, those are the books that you find in the Catholic Bible, so First Maccabees or Wisdom of Solomon or the Prayer of Manasseh or things like that. That would be in the Apocrypha. The Pseudepigrapha, you hear that word pseud, that part of it, pseud, pseudo, false. The Pseudepigrapha is writings falsely attributed to others. So, in other words, as if Enoch wrote all of this, which obviously he did not. This is part of the Pseudepigrapha, but these are mainly intertestamental books, books that were first written between the Old Testament and the New, or after the Old Testament period and the beginning of the New Testament period. You can read it with interest. Some of it is quite out there and fantastic. You can read it with interest, but you'll see it's obviously not Bible. But thank you for the call. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Nashville, Tennessee, where I am right now. Travis, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Yeah. Thank you for taking my call. It's a pleasure to talk to you again. First of all, I just wanted to say what I'm not sure. I'm not in any way an anti-Semite. In fact, I'm supportive of your program. I love the Jewish people. And so I have no interest in, you know, degrading or bringing the name down of the Jewish people. So I want to say that first, because my question following up is, if you didn't know that, you might would think that, you know, I have that bent, but I don't. Anyway, my question is about Romans 11 and so much of the eschatology, or perhaps even the emphasis of your ministry, has to do with the end-time restoration of Israel. And I guess the particular verse I'm interested in, you may be being challenged on, is where it says, in the end, so all Israel will be saved. And the word so there, and since you're a Greek expert, I understand other guys like Jay Adams and Steve Gregg, the word so can also be represented as like this, or, you know, in this way.
Mm-hmm.
And so they come from the perspective that, you know, I'm sure you're going to call it replacement theology, and maybe that would be better termed fulfillment theology, but I'm wondering if, like in Galatians 6:16, it talks about the ecclesia, the called out ones, which are us, the church, are the Israel of God. And so I'm wondering if, you know, if we're part of the root of the olive tree in Romans 11, and in this way all Israel will be saved, which we are part of, you know, isn't it possible, or isn't it at least, you know, somewhat plausible that, you know, there is a potential for a partial preterist view of end times eschatology, as opposed to, you know, what you hold as being near and dear to your heart?
Yeah, thanks for the question, and you pose it. And, of course, there's nothing anti-Semitic in what you're asking, and there are plenty of people who hold to replacement theology or fulfillment theology, or who are partial or full preterists who are not anti-Semites in any way. It's an exegetical theological difference. But is it possible, exegetically, that when Paul says all Israel, he's speaking of the church as a whole. No, it's impossible exegetically, and I'll show you how. Galatians 6:16 further supports the impossibility of that when read in the most natural level. And by the way, I work with Greek. I'm not a Greek expert. I'd be a Hebrew expert, but not a Greek expert. But in this way, meaning on the heels of the fullness of the Gentiles coming in, thereby provoking Israel to envy. And so, in this way, Israel will be saved. So we'll take a look. We got a break, so stay right there, Travis. And we'll take a look. I'll show you why, when I say impossible, anyone can believe what they want. But proper exegesis, can Israel in Romans 11:26 mean the church as a whole, Jew and Gentile? Absolutely not. Certainly not. And that's why very, very, very few, very few solid exegetes hold to that today.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back to The Line of Fire on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, 866-34-TRUTH. During the break, I was just looking for a quote from F.F. Bruce, the most heralded evangelical New Testament scholar of the last generation. And in his Romans commentary, Bruce says this, because I just use the word impossible, and you try it in a scholarly academic way to not use a word like that, and I had just used it. But Bruce says, Romans 11:26, it is impossible to entertain an exegesis which takes Israel here, verse 26, in a different sense from Israel in verse 25, blindness in part has happened to Israel. So, Travis, let me take you through this. In Romans, the 11th chapter, the whole issue that Paul is dealing with is the agony of what happened to his Jewish people, the nation as a whole rejecting only a remnant, embracing the Messiah. Does that mean that God is through with Israel? Did the promises fail? And so he begins a couple chapters earlier, saying in verse 6, it's not as though the word of God has failed, for not all who are descended from Israel belong to Israel. In other words, there's an Israel within Israel. It's not talking about Gentiles there. There's an Israel within Israel. So the remnant has received the promise. Verse 8, this means that it is not the children of the flesh or the children of God, but the children of the promise are counted as offspring. So now the question is, what about the rest of the nation? What about Israel as a whole? So he now begins to address that, and we'll see that 10 times in these chapters now, from Romans 9, 6, from here to 11, 26, he's going to talk about Israel. So the question is, when he says Israel, who is he talking about? We just want to look fairly exegetically, verse by verse by verse. Is he talking about the remnant within the nation, the spiritual children? Or is he talking about the nation as a whole? So we get to 9:27. Isaiah cries out concerning Israel, though the number of the sons of Israel be as the sand of the sea, only a remnant of them will be saved. So here twice in verse 27, he's talking about the nation as a whole and only a remnant saved. Then verse 31, he says, Israel, who pursued a law that would lead to righteousness, did not succeed in reaching that law. Who's he talking about? The remnant, the born-again believers, the nation as a whole. Nation as a whole. 9:31. Israel, who pursued a law that would lead to righteousness, did not succeed in reaching that law. Again, nation as a whole. 10:19. But I asked, did Israel not understand? Who's he talking about? Nation as a whole. Verse 21 of chapter 10. But of Israel, he says, all day long I have held up my hands to a disobedient and contrary people. He's talking about the nation as a whole. 11:2, Elijah appeals to God against Israel. Who? The sitting nation, the nation as a whole. 11:7, what then? Israel failed to obtain what it was seeking. Now we get to verse 11. So, did they stumble in order that they might fall? By no means. Rather, through their trespass, salvation has come to the Gentiles. So the Gentiles who believe, so as to make Israel jealous. So once again, Israel, the nation as a whole, the non-believers, provoked to jealousy by the Gentiles. And then he goes on with the role of the Gentiles to provoke Israel. And he says this in verse 12, if their trespass, means Israel's trespass, means riches for the world, and their failure means riches for the Gentiles, how much more will their, the Jewish people, nation of Israel, their full inclusion mean? Now I'm speaking to Gentiles. Inasmuch then as I'm an apostle to the Gentiles, I magnify my ministry in order somehow to make...
Is the word there really there in the original language? If I'm not wrong, and please correct me, isn't it so, and it just says so, and then it goes on. The word there isn't there. Is that true?
You're saying in verse 12?
The one you just read about there, and where it's in it, like italics or parentheses, like it was added for clarification.
I'm looking at it in the Greek. That's the only possible way to read it. It's, in other words, it's in opposition to their failure. Okay. In other words, if it's not their inclusion, it's not their failure either. Okay. That's the only way. The same ones who failed are the same ones who are going
to
be included. And that's why every
trend. Can you read the Greek again for me real quick? Could I bother you to read that again?
So yeah. What I just want to point out though is every verse that said Israel so far. He's talking about the nation as a whole, the nation as a whole, the nation as a whole, the nation as a whole. All right? And he's talking about Gentiles separately. All right? And there's out tone. I mean, it's there. It's there. I don't know where you're getting this from. Their fullness. I'm looking at the Greek. Okay? Pleroma, out tone. There, yeah, so it's there. That's what it is in the Greek. That's why everybody else says it. Okay, anyway, so now we come from there to 11:25. I don't want you to be ignorant of this mystery, brothers. A partial hardening has come upon Israel. He's just used Israel 10 times. He's been about the nation as a whole. All right, who is it that's hardened? Israel. Until the fullness of the Gentiles, he said the role of the Gentiles is to provoke Israel to spiritual jealousy, and there Israel's full inclusion will be the riches of the whole world, right? Partial hardening has come upon Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles has come in. Nowhere does Paul say the Gentiles are Israel. Zero. And he's had every opportunity. Instead, he says, here, it's like me saying, Travis, your role is to provoke Sam in Franklin, Tennessee to jealousy. And I use the things 10 times, Travis, Sam, Nashville, Franklin. And now suddenly you become Sam and Travis becomes, and Sam becomes Travis? No. So he now says, next verse, he says this, lest you be wise in your own sight, I do not want you to be unaware of the mystery, brothers. A partial hardening has come upon Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles has come in. And in this way, so provoked by the fullness of the Gentiles coming in, and or the Greek could also mean on the heels of, either one works. And this way, all Israel will be saved, just as Jeremiah prophesied that God would be God of all the families of Jacob. And notice what it says, the deliverer will come from Zion. He will banish ungodliness from Jacob. The church is never called Jacob. The church is never called the new Jacob or the spiritual Jacob. I don't know a single Christian that would ever use that. Banish ungodliness from Jacob, and this will be my covenant with them. Who? The people of Israel. When I take away their sins. As regards the gospel, they, who? The ones that are going to be saved in the future. They are enemies for your sake. Who? You Gentiles. But as regards election, they are beloved for the sake of their forefathers, for the gifts and the calling of God are irrevocable.
Is the word they there, or is it?
All right, Travis, just listen. To be perfectly honest, if you're going here, it's like I gave you $100 million, and you said, "Yeah, but there's a penny underneath, and that penny seems damaged." To even trivialize the question, rather than say, "Okay, the clear sense is overwhelming and devastating," and that's why almost every major commentary for years has recognized what the plain sense is. To even ask,
I just
that,
make mention of the word Israel, like in Romans 9:6. It says that not all are of Israel.
Travis, with all respect, were you not listening to anything I just read?
I was, but if you'll give me a chance to make my point, I'll try to make it clear.
All right, tell you what. I'm going to extend this one more segment, but I don't trust your listening because I read Romans 9:6. I explained Romans 9:6. I gave you 10 proofs from Scripture of what Romans 9:6 was saying and what it wasn't saying. And yet, you haven't said, okay, clear, everything's totally clear, but I still don't understand this. But I'm doing this for the benefit. I don't know if you're seriously seeking the truth. I don't know that. God knows. But for those who are, we'll continue this one more segment.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
All right, we're going to continue a discussion about Paul's meeting in Romans 11:26. By the way, let me just say this. I'm going to reach out to Jewish people every day now, every opportunity I have, because Jewish people need Jesus. And I'm not going to think, well, someone's going to be alive when Jesus returns and they'll automatically get saved. I don't believe anyone's going to be automatically saved, that whoever's living today. No, of course not. So I'm reaching out. I simply know what Scripture says. So Travis, here's where I'm being totally straight with you, all right? I'm being totally straight because I explain Romans 9:6. Paul said there's an Israel within Israel. Now let me talk to you about the nation as a whole, the Israel as a whole. So there's a remnant within the nation that's believed in every generation, but what about the nation as a whole? That's what he talks about, verse after verse after verse after verse after verse, right? So after all of that, it's almost as if, I want to be polite in saying this, but it's almost as if all you're waiting is for me to stop talking so you can make your point, because none of the evidence I'm presenting is being processed. I can't see how it's being processed.
The reason for my call is I wanted to challenge you because I know what your viewpoint is, and I was hoping to learn something from you in case it would help me adjust my thinking. So I'm not trying to dominate this by any means. I'm not a talented debater. I'm not James White.
You're listening politely, but let me help you. Process what I just told you, that Paul says there's a remnant within the nation. There's a remnant within the nation.
Right, but aren't we part of that remnant? Doesn't it say in Romans?
No, you are not part of the remnant of Israel. I am. Unless you're Jewish, you are not part of that remnant. You are a Gentile believer. We're part of the same church, part of the same family, equally sons of God.
But isn't the olive tree representative of Israel, and aren't I grafted in as a wild shoot? Aren't I part of that?
You are not. You are part of the commonwealth, the larger family. That's what Paul says in Ephesians 2. You are not Israel. Why does Paul call you a Gentile? You are a Gentile believer. I'm a Jewish believer. We are equal in Jesus. We have equal status. No, the Israel within, that is the Israel of God, Galatians 6:16. Peace be on all who follow this rule, all you Gentiles. And I'm not writing off Jewish believers. Also the Israel of God, the Greek word kai, the most natural meaning is which, that's what you'll find in almost all translations and the vast majority of commentaries is, and also speaking about the Israel of God. Paul never, ever calls Gentiles Israel, ever. We lost Travis. So Travis, don't know what happened to your connection there, but accept the fact that you're a Gentile believer. I'm a Jewish believer. We have the same God, the same Father. Here, I'm a male believer. My wife, Nancy's a female believer. We each have our own identity, but we are absolutely equal in Jesus. We are absolutely one in the Messiah. Paul says it in the midst of this discussion, Romans 10:12, that the same God is God of all, richly blessing all who call upon him. So there's no distinction in salvation between a Jew and a Gentile. There's no distinction in between forgiveness of sins. There's no distinction in terms of having God as our Father and Jesus as our Savior. No distinction. We're equal. We are absolutely one. But why, if Paul wanted to make the point that Gentile believers were spiritual Israel, why does he keep referring to them as Gentiles here when he writes in Romans 11? I'm writing to you Gentiles to provoke Israel. You could say, well, I am Israel. I am Israel now. No, obviously that was not the point. So, look, I'm totally happy for believers in many nations to have their uniqueness. They're believers in India, believers in Africa, believers around the world. I've ministered in so many of these places and the culture, believers in Korea. Some of these places I've been, the culture, and they each bring their unique being into the kingdom. And as a Jewish believer, bring my unique being into the kingdom. And together there's this beautiful tapestry that God's made. All right. Keep plugging away. Hopefully people will get it. We'll be right back.
Fire we please. It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back, friends, to The Line of Fire broadcast, 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to clip number 7. This is Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal. Clip number 7. And I just want to go back to Romans 11 one more time, but listen to what Governor Jindal has to say.
I called upon Muslim leaders to call out and denounce these murders, these terrorists. Decrying violence isn't enough. We must make clear, Muslim leaders must make clear, these individuals are not going to enjoy the afterlife. They're not going to be martyrs, but rather they're going to hell. We need to understand the challenge we face in radical Islam. In many ways, you're looking at folks that want to come in some ways, overturn our culture. They want to come in and almost colonize our countries. I think we've got to stop those people from coming into our country. But unfortunately, today, the politically correct view is to say that any view, anybody that says that is viewed as being culturally arrogant, as being insensitive, having a colonial perspective. I think that's wrong.
Yeah. Yes. It's common sense. Yes. This is nothing colonial in terms of our thinking that, well, you know, we're going to go and take over the world and make everybody like us. What we're saying is we have an American culture, an American way of life. And if you're coming to our country and your goal is to kill us, you're not welcome here. And if you're coming to our country and your goal is to take over our country and change our way of life, and that's why you're coming in, and you will use forceful, violent means to do it. If we can stop you from coming in, we ought to. What is so hard to get about that? And tell me another country on the planet that would say, oh, your goal is to destroy our values. Let me just make sure I have this. Your goal is to take away our freedoms, to subject us to your ideology, through violent means, if necessary, and you could even feel that killing our citizens is doing God's work, and you would like to become a citizen. You bet! In fact, we'll finance you. Of course not. Of course not. Just like the human race does not survive by everybody committing suicide, a nation does not survive by committing corporate suicide. Are all Muslims killers, murderers? No, God forbid. Of course not. Do all Muslims want to subject America to Sharia law? No. Do some? Yes. Do some live here? Yes. Do they make their goals known in their circles? Yes. Do we track them as we should? No. In many cases, perhaps in most cases, no. That's just foolish. And again, you have to wonder why. What's our administration thinking? What is our administration thinking? What is the goal? No, I'm not saying President Obama is a secret Muslim and he's working secretly with other Muslims, although plenty of people have enough fuel for their fire these days to argue that, don't they? They've got enough fuel for their fire to try to say, well, look, you know, you see, if you check this and look at these secret meetings with people here and there. I understand that. I'm not making that accusation. I believe that he's got great sympathy towards Islam growing up in Indonesia. I believe for whatever reason, he thinks he can be a friend of the Muslim world in ways that is unrealistic. And I think he is turning a blind eye to the reality of Islamic terror along with his administration. Why? God knows. What does it mean? Pray for our president. Pray for our administration. And then all the more, I mentioned this yesterday, but all the more, remember suffering brothers and sisters. Remember the trauma. Remember the pain. And say, God, how do you pray? What do you say? God, strengthen your persecuted people. Strengthen those who are suffering. Give them courage. Give them grace to endure. Deliver them from suffering. Save those who are attacking them. And intervene with justice to stop the slaughter. And let God be God and let God answer as he does. But at the very least, we do that. If you go to a website like persecution.com, you find out different ways that you can support. And there are other organizations out there as well. I got a note actually from the editor at Newsweek earlier today, sharing an article with me that he thought I would be interested in. So I said, I thanked him and I said, I'm going to put it up on social media and mention it on radio. But it's a cover story on Newsweek. So if you go to newsweek.com, it's the cover story. It says, is Kim Jong-un the last bad Bond guy? And obviously with reference to the James Bond movies. But it tells you a lot about what's happening in China, North Korea. It's a lot of information. It's a pretty intense article. So you may want to take a read at that. Take a look at that at newsweek.com. My appreciation to the editor there for calling it to my attention. Okay, let me go back to Romans chapter 11. And let me explain again why I agree with F.F. Bruce that it is impossible, his word, do I have that quote still in front of me? Yeah. It is impossible to entertain an exegesis which takes Israel here in a different sense. So he's talking about Romans 11, 25, 26. Israel here in a different sense from Israel in verse 25. Blindness in part happened to Israel. So let's go through this really slowly, okay? Because, you know, listening on radio, you may not have your Bible in front of you driving in the car. I want to do my best to go through this slowly. The caller was making the point that, and graciously wanted to challenge my views. My concern was that he wasn't processing what I was saying. Look, sometimes I've done that. I'm going to answer you. So you're talking, you're giving me your argument. I'm just waiting for you to get to the end of your argument so I can answer, right? As opposed to processing it and thinking through the argument and then responding. So his point was, look, Gentile believers likened to a wild olive branch coming from a wild olive tree have been grafted into Israel's olive tree, or the olive tree is Israel and the individual branches are individual believers. So the Gentile believers are grafted into Israel as opposed to grafted into the larger family of Israel. Okay, I understand the logic of that. Right, I understand that. I could see that argument. And he says this, if you, verse 24, so speaking of Gentile believers, were cut from what is by nature a wild olive tree, so Gentile stock, and grafted, contrary to nature, into a cultivated olive tree, which he would say represents Israel, how much more will these, the natural branches, speaking of individual Jews, be grafted back into their own olive tree? Then he says this, lest you, who, Gentile believers, Gentile branches, be wise in your own sight, I do not want you to be unaware of this mystery, brothers. A partial hardening has come upon Israel. Who's Israel? Jews. Which Jews in particular? The Jews who don't believe. Those are the ones who've been partially hardened. What does partial hardening mean? It's not for the whole nation. There's always a remnant, people like me who believe, or Paul in the first century. There's always a remnant who believes, and it's not for all time. At the end, the veil will be removed. So it's only partial. Upon whom? Israel. Until what? The fullness of the Gentiles has come in. So you have Israel, non-believing Israel. You have Gentiles, fullness of the Gentiles. The fullness of the Gentiles comes in. What does that do? That now provokes Israel. Or following that, this now happens. And in this way, all Israel will be saved. So what's the point? The partial hardening will end. Okay? That's his whole point. His whole point is not that the fullness of the Gentiles comes in. That now makes for all Israel. No, he's distinguished Israel from the Gentiles every single time he talks about them. Every time, without exception, there is a distinction that is made. And in this way, all Israel will be saved. Now look at this. As it is written, the deliverer will come from Zion. He will banish ungodliness from Jacob. This is not a prophecy of the Gentiles coming in. The Gentiles are not Jacob. Nowhere ever are the Gentile believers called Jacob. Jacob gives birth to a multitude of nations, if you want to say spiritually, that Israel gives birth to a multitude of nations who come to faith. Fine, but Jacob is Israel. Israel's Jacob. Jacob's never the Gentiles. Tell me about churches that say, we are the new Jacob. We are the new Jacob. We are the spiritual Jacob. No, no one think of using that term. And this will be my covenant with them who, Israel, it doesn't believe. When I take away their sins, whose sins? Israel, it doesn't believe. As regards the gospel, they, who? Gentile? No. They, these same people, the children of Israel who don't believe, they are enemies for your sake. But as regards election, they, who's they? Israel. They are beloved for the sake of their forefathers. Who? Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. For the gifts and the calling of God are irrevocable. I agree with F.F. Bruce. Impossible to read Israel verse 26 is different from Israel verse 25. Rejoice. Look in hope. There will be a future turning of the nation of Israel to Jesus, the Messiah.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back, friends, to the Line of Fire, Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Man, we are out of Thoroughly Jewish time. I can't believe it. I still have a few more minutes. All right, our friend Travis was able to call back and let us know that he didn't hang up. He just went through territory and his cell phone cut out. We didn't hang up on him, so glad everybody knows that. Yeah. I'm just looking at some news here. Jewish press reports Germany's Central Council of Jews is warning against wearing yarmulkes. Yarmulkes, that's the Jewish head covering. No, it does not go back to scripture, but it is Jewish tradition done out of Yirat Hashem or Yirat HaShemayim, out of the fear of God or the fear of heaven. It is a reminder to a Jewish person that God is above, to walk in humility, and a public statement that I am a Jew. It's a development that I did not expect 5 years ago, and that's a bit shocking. That quote in the article, Josef Schuster, a leader of the Central Council of Jews, told German radio that Jews need not hide in fear, since most Jewish institutions in Germany are protected, but in some places it's better if they don't recognize you as a Jew. To that end, Schuster recommended that Jews not wear skull caps in parts of Germany with a large Muslim population. He said, the question is whether in areas with a large proportion of Muslims it is sensible to be recognized as a Jew by wearing a kippah. That's the Hebrew word for it. The word yarmulke of uncertain origin. Some say it comes from those who fear the kingdom of heaven, but it's speculation. The question is whether in areas with a large proportion of Muslims it is sensible to be recognized as a Jew by wearing a kippah, or if it isn't better to wear some other form of head covering. He said, first quote I read, it's a development that I did not expect 5 years ago, and that's a bit shocking. Yeah, this is all. Well, let me say this. It's not surprising in that we've seen it going in this direction. And I read some years ago that Jews in Berlin were becoming concerned about wearing yarmulkes and things like that. But here, look at this. According to the Amadou Antonio Foundation, citing unpublished government figures, anti-Semitic crimes in Germany grew by more than a third last year to 1,076. These crimes included vandalizing Jewish cemeteries, painting swastikas on synagogues, and inciting anti-Semitic hate. Germany! Germany. I mean, so much of the German psyche is to work against the repeat of the environment that was there leading up to the Holocaust. And yet this is happening there. Shocking, absolutely shocking, but not surprising. And Wall Street Journal, just as we give you a couple bit of news bites here on Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, Islamic State militant known as Jihadi John identified. Mass militant who appears in several execution videos identified as British man Muhammad Emwazi. The masked Islamic State militant known as Jihadi John, who has appeared. Oh, okay, just read that. He's in his 20s. He was born in Kuwait, grew up in London, attended university in London, according to officials and a person familiar with the situation. This is what Britain was shocked with when they had their equivalent of 9/11. They were shocked to see that people who grew up in their country, trained in their culture, educated in their culture, were part of the terrorist attack. It was a painful shocker. Let me just see here if I want to. All right, one more little news item. And look, this is just to keep us alert. This is to keep us praying, acting, and to help you know as a Christian why it's so important that you're standing with Israel, why it's so important that you're praying, why it's so important that you're voting for those who stand with Israel. This is from CBS Los Angeles from 3 days ago, February 23rd. UCLA student Jewish background question during vote for judicial board. A Jewish student running for a seat on a judicial council at UCLA was questioned about how she would decide on a matter that dealt with Jewish students should she be elected, according to a video clip. Has that come up? I mean, is that a normal, expected question? Quote, given that you're a Jewish student and very active in the Jewish community, given that recently, unclear, has been surrounding cases of conflict of interest, how do you see yourself being able to maintain an unbiased view? That's when Avinoam Varal, president of the group, interrupted. The discussion was really discriminatory in nature. I had to step in and say my piece. Another UCLA student said, I was honestly just sickened by the way they questioned her. And UCLA's vice chancellor of student affairs, Janita Montero, released a statement which read in part, I believe our community is more generous, thoughtful, and inclusive than this particular incident would suggest. But remember, there's a lot of hostility towards Israel and the Jewish people on college campuses. There is a ton of it on college campuses. The boycott, divestment, sanctions movement, the BDS movement, it's rampant. And we must reach out to the younger generation and help them understand why it's important to stand with Israel. All right, friends, I cannot recommend too strongly this wonderful DVD, 96 minutes, all right, 96 minutes long, and accompanying that, two CDs with terrific interviews with creation scientists. These young earth creationists, they believe that the earth is not millions of years old, but more importantly, in terms of the larger scientific issue, they believe Darwinian evolution is fatally flawed. And they give, I think, 15 reasons, articulate, clear, well illustrated, well explained. So it's a great resource, and we put together a great package, only $25 postage paid. Order as many copies as you want. I'd really recommend get one set for yourself and then get a set for friends, because somebody's going to have questions, somebody's going to be struggling, somebody's going to be wondering, and you will have the ready information for them. All right, so here's the number to call, 1-800-278-9978. 1-800-278-9978. Once more, 1-800-278-9978. If you've never had questions about evolution, I just find it, as I'm watching and rewinding some of the clips just to take in everything again because of my lack of scientific training and appreciate it, it enhances my esteem for God, the marvelous, amazing creator. All right. You can also go to the website, Ask Dr. Brown, askdrbrown.org, and click on Latest Article. After you check out the resource offer there, there's a video that tells you a bit more as well. Oh, by the way, had a great, great time at National Religious Broadcasters, a forum on the Bible and homosexuality. I was one of four panelists hosted by Janet Parshall. And hopefully as early as next week, we'll be playing clips for you. And as soon as the video is available, we will let you know. And I think it'll be a great, great resource, great to watch. Okay, my bottom line today. Yes, there are areas of debate in Scripture, but I believe if we submit ourselves to the Word of God and impartially follow the evidence, we will recognize there will be an end time Jewish turning to the Messiah.